Welcome to the Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and a week ago, I came across the Kickstarter campaign of a vegan couple named Tom and Sol to launch their fantastic illustrated book called Reynard the House Wolf, which is all about escaping the city, reconnecting with nature, and growing curious, compassionate, and loving towards our fellow animals. The message behind this project, its philosophy, and just how thoughtful and talented Tom and Sol are compelled me to support their Kickstarter campaign and invite them on the show for an incredible conversation on their journey out of the city and the power of their art. But before that, let me play a segment of their Kickstarter campaign trailer. Hopefully this will inspire you to support them. Enjoy.
This book is perfect for kids who are too old for typical children's books and are in need of something to challenge, excite, and inspire them.
But really, we've made a work that we hope will help readers of all ages to connect with our deeper nature.
It certainly helped us.
During the 4 years we spent crafting this work, our real life mirrored Reynard's adventure as we relocated from our city life to life in our off-grid cabin on the shore of Lake Superior, where Reynard has finally found the forests of his dreams.
In the end, Reynard is a metaphor for all of us.
At once a wolf and a dog.
With two paws in the forest.
Two paws in the city.
And a heart that won't be tamed.
So, hi, Tom and Sol. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having us. We're really looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, you're here today because I've always had this idea that the city has something evil to it and that it was always worth it to go out of the city and reconnect with nature. But you took it like a step further than what I was thinking, you know, which is living in the suburbs or maybe a smaller town. You actually live in the wilderness, and I want to talk about this to start the conversation. So what motivated you to make that decision, and how was it?
Yeah, well, like you say, a lot of people maybe have the feeling that living in the middle of the city, surrounded by traffic and light pollution and nonstop noise and, you know, all of these factors which didn't exist for the hundreds of thousands of years that humans have evolved in freedom of nature, you know, that does have a jarring effect on people, whether we know it or not. And increasingly, Sol and I were feeling that. And we also had just acquired a beautiful border collie puppy named Reynard. And when you get a dog, it's kind of like having a child. You know, you stop thinking about only yourself, but what is the kind of life that I want my dog to have? And we were really excited about him being able to run around freely and kind of live the life of his dreams. So I guess that's kind of what started our quest to find a piece of property. We wanted to be as close to a large forest, ideally an old growth forest, protected forest, a place that was so wild that there are actually wolves in it. We wanted to be near water. We had kind of this fantasy, which seemed impossible to achieve. But lo and behold, now we live in an off-grid cabin right next to the Porcupine Mountains in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is the largest old growth forest in Michigan. And we live on the shore of Lake Superior, which is the largest freshwater lake on Earth. And Reynard really has found the land of his dreams now, and so have we. And of course, it has its difficulties. We live off-grid, and we don't have electricity or running water. But the difficulties are really part of the learning experience.
Also, Tom and I, since we met, we have been traveling to many countries and we have volunteered for different projects working in farms. So we had already experienced being off-grid and in nature with these programs. We always had like other people with us. This is the first time we're just by ourselves. But We enjoyed being in nature and not having the internet connection all the time, So we would enjoy playing music, writing, walking in the forest, or just being in silence. And I think that that experience really opened our eyes to what our life could be if we moved to the countryside or to the forest.
Yeah, like a few years ago, we did a backpacking trip in India, and we spent 6 months with no cell phone, no laptop, no gadgets of any kind. So you can imagine the difficulty of traveling in a foreign country with no connection. But it led to so much connection with ourselves, like when you have no distractions. And so that's kind of what we were looking for also, is a place where we were limited by how much internet we can have. Be That's one of the main challenges in the modern world, is being able to focus your mind and not get distracted by stuff on the internet. So now we have some solar power, and for example, as we're giving this podcast with you, the solar power is counting down: 98%, 95%, 92%. So we've got plenty of time, but we do have to think about, when we're just cruising on the internet later, how much time are we gonna spend, checking Instagram or Facebook? Because then maybe we can't use the coffee grinder tomorrow.
Yeah, is it worth it to watch the cat videos right now or
When I hear you talk about that way of life, it just brings me so much joy. But I know for a fact that for most people, that would be hell. And why do I know that? Well, I went to a meditation retreat, and it was, in the middle of nowhere, and no internet, nothing. And you were in this cabin, middle of the woods. And I felt so good. I spent a week in that cabin, and it was wonderful. What a wonderful time I had. And then at the end of the retreat, I was talking to one of the monks there, so it was a monastery, and he said, it's a great thing you've done, because most people quit after day one. Actually, they don't go beyond, the night." And I thought, "Oh, that's weird. Why is that?" And he said, "I don't know. Maybe it's just they're, for the first time in a while, they're just alone with their thoughts, and it's just a hard experience for them." So I guess, what do you make of the people who would feel like this is torture, living disconnected and away from everything?
Yeah, well, there is a transition period, of course. If you go from high stimulus living to suddenly being without a connection in the middle of the forest, the first 2 or 3 days can be a strange and restless experience. But it's all about how you frame things. Like we say, you are disconnected, but actually, we think of it as being reconnected. You are limited by not having internet and limitless electricity. But actually, those limits give you new freedom to explore other sides of yourself. Like, both of us are creative people. Soul is an artist, and I'm a writer, and we both play music. And for any kind of creative work, you really have to have some inner peace and outer peace, and have a place where you can concentrate. So I think people will explore a lot about themselves, discover a lot that is currently buried in the noise of civilization. But it is a difficult transition. We've experienced that personally. And I did a meditation retreat once, and I had the experience the first day of almost going crazy, just trying to sit in silence for several hours, which is something like a dog or a cat or an animal does all the time. But for me, it was torturous. So I definitely can empathize with those people.
Also, we have been living in this cabin for 3 and a half years. And in the beginning, when we would come back from the city from visiting our families or so, it felt so weird suddenly not having access to internet all the time. And sometimes I would just look at my phone, knowing that nothing was going to be there. I wouldn't receive an email or anything, but I just had like the ha habit of doing that. And the first 2 or 3 days, it felt weird. I just didn't know what to do with my time. And I knew this is so silly. Like I should just go and play music, do something. And then I would just get into that mood and start doing things. And I realized, wow, the days are so much longer now that I'm not wasting my time. You know, internet is very useful. We all know that, but we also know that we spend a lot of time just doing nonsense. And yeah, living here, it really opened my eyes to that and what I can achieve when I'm more centered and doing things that I really love and that contribute to my well-being.
Yeah, you really do gain more time when you limit the role that technologies and screens play in your life. You know, maybe you're going to live the same amount of time. Let's say you live to be 80 years either way. But the amount of time you have within a day, it's like suddenly you have many more hours that would have just like, you know, we've all had the experience of scrolling on social media and you go into zombie mode and basically your consciousness kind of goes to a very low vibration, and you check your watch, and suddenly 3 hours have passed, and you have no idea what happened. So, when you remove those experiences from the equation, now you do have the time to write that screenplay you always wanted to do, or to, you know, learn jujitsu, or whatever it is the goal that you have in your mind. A big part of that is just finding the time, and increasingly, screens and technology, we think of these as time-saving machines, but ironically, they really remove quite a lot of time from our lives.
To be fair, you know, the story I told, in that meditation retreat, you could not make a sound, like you needed to keep silent. And so, yeah, you could not, you know, play music or do anything fun. What about socialization? I guess you're both of you introverts, because when I have that discussion with extroverts, you know, they're not into it, because there's no one around. You know, your closest neighbor is really far. So, how do you resolve that problem?
Right. Well, I think, you know, if you are a person who likes making art and music and that sort of thing, it requires being a little introverted. I don't really believe in those terms of introvert and extrovert exactly, because of course we love our alone time and we need it to make art and music and things, but we also love being with people. It's just you need balance in your life. And I think of course, some people are maybe more social than others, but often it's like you were saying, we can use kind of the noise of the world to cover up maybe that peace within ourselves. And for some people, that might be watching a lot of TV 10 hours a day. For other people, maybe they require nonstop socialization, perhaps because they love people, but also maybe out of fear of what happens when you're alone by yourself. You know, what thoughts will come to the surface? So, you know, we enjoy going to parties and social gatherings as much as anybody, but we don't want to sacrifice the connection to our interior worlds, you know? So you do have to drive further to meet people. For us, it's a 20-minute drive just to the closest town of about 1,000 people. It's basically a gas station and a general store and, you know, a diner, which does not have any vegan food, so we don't go there. And then it's maybe 40-minute drive to a larger town of 3,000, 4,000 people. So yeah, we get used to making fewer trips and seeing fewer people. But then when we are with those people, we really value the experience. And we, of course, love having folks come out to visit us. You know, we all summer when the weather is nice, we have people coming to visit.
Yeah. I personally, when we go to visit his family in Kansas City, I have so many friends in Kansas City because we used to live there for a few years. And when I'm there, I just try to see them all. Like sometimes my schedule is full just from friends' visits and just catching up. And I love that. And then when I'm here, it's more quiet. And I think that that balance works for me.
And we have our dogs too, you know.
Yeah, they are great company.
Dogs are hilarious. Our dog Reynard, who we wrote this book and Sol illustrated the book called Reynard the House Wolf, which normally you read a book and it's all fiction. And this is a fictional story of this dog who runs away from the city to seek out the real world nature channel. But Reynard is actually a real dog. He's lying on his bed on the floor right next to us as we speak. And basically, this book seems like it's a fictional account, but it's, more or less his real adventure on a metaphorical level. He really did leave the city and find a place with wild wolves. In the book, he has conversations with the wolves, and they all rhyme, and it's all beautiful. Of course, in the real world, we try to keep Reynard away from the wolves because they may not get along very well, but it was important in the book for them to be able to have this conversation. He's able to speak in the book to a number of animals, which in real life, the conversation might not go so well. But in the fictional world, it allows us to explore a lot of important ideas and have a good time.
You talked about wolves, and I think it's the one of those top things that stop people from escaping the city, fear of the wilderness. And it's an actual thing that the monastery I talked about, I sent a friend there. I gave her that place as a recommendation, and she went there, and she was able to stay longer than a night. But she was scared, like out of her mind, every night because she would hear all of those sounds in the forest and she would think, oh, it's a bear. It's definitely a bear. And that bear is coming to eat me or something. And it sounds silly when you take some distance from that moment and you think, no, there was no bear. It's just my imagination. It is, obviously irrational, but what do you make of that fear we have of the forest, of nature, of the wilderness?
I think that, the animals that live in this area, they are not used to people. So we don't see them coming to us like to get food or anything, which I think that can create a problem. When bears come into your trash cans searching for food and they don't get what they want, maybe they can get aggressive. We don't have grizzly bears here, so I'm not afraid of the black bears. I know that they are more afraid of me than I am of them. And yeah, we, I mean, I'm not afraid when I go walking in the woods by myself. I've seen black bears here, but they just run off. They are afraid of my dogs. They just run. And wolves, we haven't seen any wolves.
We've seen them on the trail
We have
camera.
seen them on the trail camera, but not like clear in the day. They know we are here and they don't wanna come close. And I respect their lives. I don't wanna mess with their territory, and I think they feel the same. They don't wanna come close. They have nothing to gain from coming close to us. So we just.
I mean, most wild animals are really not very interested in humans, except for the fact that we leave trash and food scraps and things tossed around everywhere, and that will attract those animals. We have cougars here, we have black bears, we have wolves and coyotes, and we don't think of these creatures as our enemies. They're out there, they have their lives that they've evolved for hundreds of thousands, millions of years to fulfill. And those lives generally do not include eating humans. Black bears, people are afraid of black bears. Black bears are almost completely vegan. They're mainly eating berries and leaves and roots and things. And yeah, they'll eat a fish on occasion, but these are not big carnivorous animals. They just look scary from afar. And you definitely need to know some things. Like if you see a black bear, especially if it's a mother with her cubs, you want to back away slowly. You never want to run from an animal because running will trigger an animal maybe to want to chase. But if you know how to respond, just backing away slowly until you can, find some shelter somewhere. That's even in a worst case scenario. In most scenarios, the moment an animal sees you, it's going to be the one who wants to run away. But like we live in this place where there's loads of black bears, and they almost never have any interaction with people. The last time I heard, there was a visitor at the park who got his truck broken into by a black bear. And when the story came out, it turns out that he was a honey salesman. He was a traveling honey salesman. So, this sounds like a cartoon, but these creatures are really not looking to get into problems unless we are creating obvious problems for them to get into. So, for the person who is going on that retreat out in the forest and they hear the sounds out in the night, that is something so magical that most people never get access to. So I would find that a very valuable experience that we should be very grateful to have.
Well, I think it's one of the symptoms of our alienation from nature. We have been, completely cut off from the natural world. We don't see ourselves as animals or as being part of that kingdom. The irony of being afraid of bears when we are the one, pushing them into extinction. We are really the scary creatures here, not them. But yeah, it's still in culture. In podcasting, the king of podcasting is Joe Rogan, and he doesn't miss a chance to talk about how bears are these horrible, murderous creatures, like every time. And yeah, it gets tiring to see them as, potential threats.
I think a big part of it also is fear of darkness, because for a lot of people, as a child, many of us, such as myself, we had a fear of darkness, a fear of the darkness in the closet, underneath the bed, or maybe our parents give us a nightlight, and then we're surrounded by streetlights our whole life, and so we never really experience darkness. And the same as when you were a kid underneath the bed, you imagined something terrible down there. Now, when we're out in our cabin in the woods, it would be easy to imagine terrible things out there at the in the night, except for we've been here so long and we know that it isn't like that. I take strolls in the middle of the night. We'll go out stargazing, or if there's the northern lights, then we'll walk a mile down the road to see northern lights in the middle of the night. And it's like you were saying, it's the lack of familiarity with these situations, the lack of understanding, which breeds fear. And the darkness is a perfect example, because we fear the dark, and that's why in the cities we light it up, because we think it's going to reduce crime. But in eliminating the darkness, we're also eliminating all the great things, like the stars and the moon and the northern lights, and also just the sense of peace that the darkness brings. So I think we could probably apply that logic to a lot of these threats that we try to defeat, such as wildlife. In getting rid of these so-called threats, we're also losing that connection with our deeper selves, which humans have had for millions of years. So that's, what we're trying to reestablish out here, and what we're trying to inspire others to do with the book and with some other projects that we've got lined up. For us, it's one thing to do this as our own personal quest, but we also feel compelled to want to share it with others, as you are doing with your podcast and so many other folks are doing, because that's really when we start to see change, is when people all start to communicate with one another.
Yeah, I would not compare your beautiful project to my podcast. I think yours is just incredible. Okay, you mentioned the porcupines. Sorry, I'm forgetting the name. What is the name of the place?
Porcupine Mountains,
Yeah.
because the native people named them that because they seem to be shaped like porcupines. They're not big rocky mountains, they're Midwestern mountains.
Yeah, so the Porcupines Mountain, and I noticed in your online, e-commerce shop that you sell lots of merch, related to that, artwork that you've done, I think, Saul. And there were many items with the message, I think, protect Porcupines Mountain. So, what are we protecting Porcupine's Mountain from exactly?
Right. So, as we've been crafting this book, actually, we started the book before we moved here. And when we moved here in this beautiful place next to the largest old growth forest in Michigan, we've got old growth forest right outside our doorstep, basically, next to Lake Superior, the largest, cleanest of all freshwater lakes. The Porcupine Mountains are also a very popular park. They were ranked recently as the most beautiful state park in the country and ranked again this year as Michigan's favorite state park. So it seems like a place that would obviously be protected. And yet there is currently a proposal for a large copper mine to be developed right next to the old growth forest and right next to Lake Superior. And the concern there, I mean, there are many concerns. Mines can be highly contaminating, especially of fresh water. But it also requires clear cutting dozens of acres of forest, hundreds of acres of forest, destroying wetlands, and storing quite a lot of waste. I wasn't familiar with all the waste that is created from mining. But for example, in this case, the copper that they're mining would only comprise less than 2% of what comes out of the ground. So they would have to store tens of millions of tons of waste containing heavy metals like arsenic, lead, cadmium, mercury. All of this on site on topography that slopes towards Lake Superior. We happen to be the only people who live out here. We have no neighbors within 5 miles. And so there, a lot of times when somebody speaks up for an ecological cause, they also have a personal stake in the game. And in many cases, the industries try to put these contaminating operations in a place where nobody is going to think about them, like factory farms, for example. We never see factory farms advertised anywhere. You don't see billboards for factory farms driving down the highway. You don't see signs for factory farms. Most people could not tell you where they are. And the same thing with a contaminating operation like a mine. Of course, it's determined by where the metals are available, but it's also something that they try to hide. They try to advertise. And so this company did not want anybody to know that they were seeking to develop this mine right next to one of the country's favorite state parks, largest old growth forests in the Midwest. And we decided to speak up about it. We started a campaign called Protect the Porkies. The Porkies are the kind of popular name for the Porcupine Mountains. And we've had quite a lot of success with that campaign. We managed to get a $50 million grant from the state blocked that was going to be awarded to the mining company. We helped organize a water walk in which members of some of the local indigenous tribes here carried water 30 miles on foot and poured it into the lake in response to the proposed mine. And all of this, it's so strange because in the Reynard the House Wolf book, which we started before we knew about the Porcupine Mountains, before we knew about this proposed mine, it talks about the threat that these wolves are facing from all of the mining taking place in the mountains. And I had never even really thought about mining. It was just something that sort of came out in the story. And then lo and behold, less than 2 years later, we find ourselves in a situation where the wolves are really being threatened by mining. And it kind of felt like something of a mystical moment where we had had this premonition about the direction our lives were going to take in the fictional world. So yeah, Sol helps manage the social media and she's done a lot of artwork and some of the merch that you've seen that's come from folks in the community who have made posters and stickers and all sorts of things.
Yeah, last year we organized a contest, an art contest, and all these artists submitted this beautiful artwork. So we made it into postcards, posters, and now t-shirts and hoodies to be able to support the campaign because Tom and I don't get any
Salary.
salary, to work on this campaign. But Tom has spent thousands of hours working on this, so this is the way that we support and we can keep doing it. But we feel very grateful because there are so many people who care about the Porcupine Mountains and this area, about the wildlife. They have a strong connection because some people have been coming to this park for their whole lives and they know how precious it is, how beautiful, unique, clean, and they want to protect it. So we just started the website, and then all these people showed up. So we are very grateful.
Yeah, we have a petition on change.org/protect the porkies where folks can read about the case, or they can go to protecttheporkies.com. But almost a 500,000 people have signed that petition now. Change.org was so impressed that they've reached out to us and had us give presentations to their company because we did a lot of work, but it's also just a message that resonates with people. And all along the way, we try to involve art and culture, because we've learned increasingly that you can't just convince people with arguments and statistics and facts. So much of what we do comes from how we feel, and how we feel is determined by art and music and storytelling and personal relationships. So that's why we try to get the arts involved. We're going to launch a songwriting contest for the Protect the Porkies campaign in just a few weeks. And that's also, of course, why we put the book together, and as well as some other projects we're working on. It's all about trying to interact on that subconscious realm. I think of it as like we see a tree above the ground, and we see the trunk and the branches, and we think, wow, what a majestic tree. But without the roots that are invisible underneath the surface, there would be no tree. So those roots are all of the arts and the music and the conversations, everything that creates our feelings, which then leads to real world action. It's the same in the vegan movement. There's only so far we can go with just convincing people and showing images and citing statistics. We really have to delve into that deeper level.
Of course, our listeners will find links to, the shop and also the petition in the episode's notes. And, again, it is worth visiting the shop. There are some beautiful items. I will definitely shop, some of that Protect the Porkies merch. Also, there are beautiful items perfect for gifts, such as the, what is it called, the earrings that you design, sold beautiful. I will certainly, get some of that. And the postcards, oh my gosh, I'm still, I still use postcards for, birthdays and stuff like that. I think it adds, a personal touch. So yeah, I was really happy to find them on your website.
Oh, we're excited to know that people still use postcards.
For me, receiving a handwritten letter or postcard from a friend is such a precious thing. And I have, well, in the beginning of our relationship, we were in different countries. I was in Spain, he was in the US, and we would write letters, and it was the most beautiful thing for me to receive one. And I kept doing that with friends because I've been living in different countries, leaving my friends behind. And I just love that feeling of spending some time just with a piece of paper, writing your thoughts and your love and everything, and then for that person to receive it eventually. And if it has cool art in it with a postcard, it's even better.
Exactly. You want something, if you're creating a personalized experience or gift for someone, you also want that to be from an artist you know. You don't want some generic postcard made in China or something like that. I guess you want, a deeper level of personalization. And what you said about Tom, about inspiring people, and not, being stuck in the, I guess, right side of your brain, which is more analytical and data driven. It's something I try to convince people to consider time and times again in my professional life, as a fundraiser, but also in this movement. Okay, let's talk a little about veganism. And I don't know if you watch some of those vegan influencers on YouTube, but there is a trend of vegans going in rural areas, the whole homestead thing. And after a while, always, it's a rule, they stop being vegan, and they become full-fledged farmers with you know, chickens and all of that. And they always cite, because they always have to talk about it, how they decided to leave veganism behind. And they always talk about how isolating it feels to be vegan in a community where everyone is a farmer or something like that. So how do you maintain a vegan lifestyle in the wilderness?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think anybody became vegan to win a popularity contest. You know, I've been vegan for 21 years now. When I was 15, I became vegan, and I was one of only two or three vegans in my high school, and frequently got, you know, picked on by people, teased. People would ask all of the ridiculous questions, like, okay, well, what if you were on a deserted island and there was only a cow? What would you, you know, you get used to. It's not that they were mean, they were just very curious. And, you know, teenagers are always a little bit mean. But so we've already been kind of trained in following a way of life that isn't practiced by all of our friends, certainly not by our families. It's something we're doing because we believe in, not because the community is doing it, not because everybody we know is going to think how cool we are. So I would say if somebody stops being vegan because they're surrounded by cattle ranchers or whatever, then maybe they weren't being vegan for the right reasons. It's like if we were surrounded by cannibals, would we suddenly, yeah, maybe I'll pick up a human leg one day? No, there's something called morality, which you don't just flick on and off like a light switch. And, you know, I think a lot of people in the vegan world really love eating out, which is great to eat out. There's some delicious vegan restaurants. But we've always been folks who enjoy just like simple cooking and cooking for ourselves, both because it's cheaper and because, to be honest, the meals that you can make for yourself are very often much more delicious than what you will get in a restaurant. But I think for some people, if you move out to the middle of a rural area and you don't have a vegan-friendly health food store next door, and you don't have 10 vegan restaurants and cafes with vegan cupcakes, it might feel like, oh my God, what are we doing? But you know, we have a we're fortunate because we have a health food co-op about a 40-minute drive away, which is much further away than most folks in the city. But if we want to go get some soy meat or whatever, we can do that. But also, you know, it's amazing what you can find in Walmart and in Super One, and any grocery store is going to have fruits and vegetables and nuts and
Tofu.
beans. Yeah, tofu. So all the things, all the staples of a vegan diet, you can get them in any grocery store in the 21st century. It really doesn't matter where you are. We've lived in Spain, we've lived in South America, we've lived in Poland, many different countries, and we have been vegan everywhere. So I would say,
Even traveling,
yeah,
that,
traveling.
you know, sometimes people say, oh, I was traveling and I couldn't be vegan. I know that. I mean, I don't want to judge people. They might have their different reasons. But for us, we have always kept being vegan, even when traveling, even in very difficult situations. There were always nuts and different things that we could eat. But something cool about living here in the forest and being, well, I don't know if it's just being vegan, but just being curious, we started learning about foraging, and we have all these, like, berries that we have been eating in the summer. There are so many blackberries, raspberries, blueberries everywhere. Also, we learned about mushroom foraging, and we learned to recognize the ones that are very, very safe to eat. Like, we will not eat something that we don't know what it is. But there is like chicken of the woods, shrimp of the woods, oyster mushrooms. It's funny, they all have names of animals. But they taste delicious, and we love to eat those, and we have been learning a lot, and it's just very fun to see everything that you can get from the land, and it's pure, it's clean, it's delicious, very precious.
Yeah, they do name a lot of these mushrooms, these culinary mushrooms, after animals. And chicken of the woods, is very delicious. It does taste, it has a rich kind of meaty texture, like a tofurkey-like texture almost. And mushrooms are another case where people fear what they don't understand. There's actually very few mushrooms that are deadly poisonous. There's quite a few that will upset your stomach. But once you learn the ones that are safe to eat, it's like having a grocery store, not too far out of your backyard. So I would say to those folks who move out to the country, if you make a moral choice, you should stick with your moral choice. And if you want to be a farmer, great, be a vegan farmer. It's a thing that people do. Grow those fruits and vegetables.
For me, it came as a surprise because I always thought that if someone goes out of the city and connects with nature, then this will be one more argument for them to keep, stay vegan or become vegan. But, you witness the opposite. So it's very counterintuitive for me. Do you feel like your experience of being close to nature has deepened your commitment to animals?
Yes, very much so. Like for me personally, I think for all of us, we became vegan because we already felt a connection with animals. And for many of us, and for myself, it was my connection with my pets, my dogs, my cats. And I thought, well, if I wouldn't kill and exploit and eat those animals, then why would I eat any animal? But very often we think about these domesticated animals and these so-called farm animals like pigs and chickens and cows, but we don't spend so much time thinking about all of the animals, and not just animals, but plants and mushrooms. I think all of nature has a degree of sentience and consciousness, and all of these incredible life forms that are existing out there in the world, and they all exist in relation to one another. Like a wolf would be nothing without the river and without the trees and without the deer and without the mushrooms and the mosses. Ecosystems are all about relationality. And that's why it is so disturbing the way that the human civilization is just sort of steamrolling over all of this infinite complexity of nature, which has been evolving for billions of years. We steamroll it over like we're shaking an Etch-a-Sketch just to have a blank slate and then put up a mine or a Walmart or a new highway or whatever. And animals are definitely the most charismatic, representatives of nature. Like any ecological campaign often will highlight a panda bear or a fox or some charismatic animal. But the animals are really the transition into having an empathy also for the whole ecosystem, because everything is dependent on everything else, and humans of course are a part of that. But I guess to answer your question more directly, of course with my dogs, I have a very personal relationship with them, but you can care about and honor animals that you never have to see personally. Like we know that these wolves are out there. We've seen them on the trail camera. We haven't ever met them up close. We know that there's cougars out there, that there are weasels and all kinds of frogs and newts and amazing insects. And we don't have to have them as close to us as we have our pets in order to respect them and in order to want them to have happiness and freedom.
Yes, and I agree with what you said about developing a connection first with your pets. This was my case. I had a dog growing up. It's a weird story, but he was my friend, that dog, and there were cats too, stray cats, and those experiences of having those animals near me and developing relationships with them is really what drove me to become vegan. I always say I became vegan out of love for animals, not because I watched some horrendous footage I also really appreciate the nugget of insight that you gave about the minds and how this was mentioned in the book in a prophetic way, which really feels like this a book was meant to be. So how did it start? You know, did you wake up one day and thought, okay, we need now to create an art book?
I don't remember the exact moment when we decided we wanted to create a children's book. I just remember that I made an illustration of Reynard. I had just acquired an iPad and I was testing it, and I made this illustration of him, and we both really liked that illustration. And at some point we decided it would be cool to make this a story, and we thought we would make a children's book, and it would have around 25 illustrations. And Tom wrote the story. We all thought it was really cute and funny and sweet. But then we realized that we had the opportunity to create something really special. And the story became longer. It then rhymed. He transformed it into a poem. And we decided that it was worth it to illustrate every page. So now we have 160 illustrations for our graphic novel. It's not a children's book anymore. It's for really everybody who would like to enjoy this story.
Yeah, it started as a children's book, as Sol said, and then we decided graphic novel really shows that it can appeal to anybody because, I mean, for me, what we made is it would have been my favorite book if I was 10 years old or 12 years old. But it would also, I think, be a great art book, a great story for anybody to enjoy. We all have an inner child within us. We all love awesome art. And we were also hoping to convince folks that poetry can be fun. The whole thing rhymes, as Sol said. And, you know, you were talking about how your connection with animals, with your pets of the duck and these stray cats, led to you being vegan. And that is part of our secret intention with this book. We didn't want to make a book called Reynard, the Awesome Vegan Dog, because then a lot of people would not even consider opening it, right? People hear that word and they tune out and they say, oh, I've already heard about that on Joe Rogan. So, you know, not even going to think about it. But there's no mention of veganism in Reynard the House Wolf, although Reynard, our real dog, is fully vegan, as well as our other dog, Shanty. However, in his travels in this book, he meets all of these animals, like a squirrel trying to cross the road, like a seal who's battling plastic bags, a black-footed ferret who is separated from another ferret by habitat fragmentation, these wolves. But what one of the and to all of these animals, he gives them names. They don't have names. And he finds that strange. Why is it that I, as a dog, have this name, but none of you have names? And some of the animals don't really understand being named and they don't want it. Like the crow doesn't want a name. He says, why limit myself with a name when I can be infinite? But one of the animals that he meets is this pig number 3285, which jumps out the back of a factory farm truck on the way to the slaughterhouse. And Reynard becomes best friends with this pig. And he says, number 3285 is a terrible name. And he renames the pig Patrick. And Patrick reflects at great length on his experience of living in darkness, crammed together with all these other pigs. He doesn't have a word for sky or ground or trees.
Or clouds.
He's asking Reynard, you know, what are all these things around us? But Patrick, the same as Reynard, has had this dream about reconnecting with his inner warthog out there in the forest and discovering all of this stuff that was denied to him on the factory farm. So without having to talk about factory farming directly, without having to talk about veganism, we are hoping that Reynard acts as a transitionary character to help readers discover the greater empathy that they have, not just for their pets, but for farm animals, for wild animals, and for the greater natural world.
I agree with you so much. The number of children's books made by vegans that are too on the nose are just, you know, so because then what you want to create is really a children's book for children, vegan children, not really, you know, the public at large. I really love the idea. You're just making me fall in love again with this book. And I'm really looking forward to getting the book in my hands. Do you think there is such a thing as vegan art? Because I made an episode about the Art of Compassion Project. Do you know about these people?
No, but sounds very interesting.
Yes, they are a group, there's a term for it, but they're a group of artists from around the world who are all vegans. And they create vegan art. So usually it is from the point of view of animals or depicting, you know, animal cruelty. And they sell that art and, you know, they use the profits to help vegan organizations or sanctuaries, things like that. But do you think there is such a thing as vegan art? Because we see depiction of animals from non-vegans. And, you know, from my point of view, I see a difference. I really see two-dimensional creatures when it's a non-vegan depiction. But with vegans, there is more depth to the animal. And that's just one example I could give. But have you had that realization?
Yeah, I think that is a great reflection that you've had about the depth that vegans will give to animals. Animals will become characters in a vegan story or in a vegan work, as opposed to just objects. You know, I think maybe for a lot of these non-vegan creators, they've spent their whole lives seeing animals as objects. You know, even their pets potentially are kind of like a piece of furniture, maybe with a bit of personality. But like I look at Reynard and any of our pets that we've had, and I see them, I see the light in their eyes. I see them as having a soul, the same as me and you. And I don't mean the word soul in any like specific religious sense, but just in the idea that we all have an interior world and we all have thoughts and dreams and we all want freedom and health and happiness. And any vegan who's had such a revelation that they've changed their diet, they've changed how they spend their money, they've changed the clothing they wear. For most people, you vote once every 4 years, and then the rest of the time you can tune out. But a vegan, every single day, we are taking conscious political action to make the world a better place, not just for ourselves, but for all of these other creatures that we share the world with. So if you've had that kind of inner realization, it's going to change the stories that you tell. It's going to change the art and the music that you make. So 100%, I think, you know, is there such a thing as vegan art or not vegan art? It's kind of a, you know, a semantic discussion, but I think the intention, there certainly will be a different intention. Is the creator seeing an animal as an object or a subject?
But also there is the aspect of the materials, which for a long time I hadn't thought about it. But then I researched, and in watercolors or in acrylic paints, oil paints, you can have paints that have bones from animals, or there are glues that have parts of animals, you know, from rabbits or fish. And I hadn't really thought about that until I made the conscious decision of just trying to use vegan materials only. So I had to switch my brushes so that they would be all synthetic and all my paints would be vegan, my paper, my glues, everything. And I'm very happy that I did that. I made that conscious choice and I changed everything, because now from a material aspect, my art is vegan.
That's a really good point. Yes, I think maybe vegan art is a bad way to represent it. Maybe it's just art that is closer to reality. I was watching recently an episode of The Kingdom of David. So weird thing to watch for me, but It's an Amazon Prime TV series, and it's about, you know, the biblical story of how the kingdom of David was established. And at some point, they needed to make a sacrifice for God, and they presented it as something very wholesome, so an animal sacrifice. And I was just looking at it, you know, watching the episode, thinking, are they going to show the poor little lamb getting, you know, slaughtered, and the visuals of it? How are they going to frame it? And of course, they did not. They did not show the scene of the slaughter. They just showed the before and after moment. And by doing that, they could, you know, camouflage the whole thing as something very wholesome. But in there, in that, you know, in hitting that visual portrait, there is a confession that people would not appreciate to see a lamb getting slaughtered, that there is something inherently cruel and shocking and violent to watching something like that. So when I see, you know, vegans not shying away to represent animal cruelty, that's also something, you know, closer to reality, but I don't see that so much from non-vegan artists.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, for almost all of the movies and series that are out there, you know, all of the TV shows, it's all about humans talking to other humans, killing other humans, having relationships with other humans, doing crimes against humans. You almost never even see an animal, in any movie or in any TV show, except as a secondary kind of object in the background or whatever. Of course, there are exceptions. There are some great stories out there which are all about animals. But in general, in our storytelling, still, it's all about humans, which is interesting because humans are less than 1% of 1% of 1% of all of the life forms out there. You know, as soon as we start opening the door to all of these other creatures, these other life forms, there are so many more stories we can tell. There is so much more that we can learn and explore. So it's really is a big limitation, in addition to being dishonest, you know, to not showing that lamb being sacrificed. It's also a big limitation in not showing the role that animals play in culture and the role that animals play in the wilderness. You know, if art is meant to give us the full story of existence, then it should teach us something about what's happening in the forest, even when humans aren't out there. It should teach us about what's happening on the factory farm, even if there's no cameras there, right? It should teach us about what was happening in ancient Egypt and in ancient Israel and all of these places to the animals. We don't hear about the animals very much. So art definitely needs to shed a light on all of these aspects that so far storytelling has kept hidden.
Yeah, I'm very grateful that there are artists who are exploring these topics and showing a very hard reality to people. I tried to make a collection of paintings some years ago showing the pollution of the oceans and how all these animals were getting entangled in plastic bags and fish factory farms and all of that. And it really drained me so much. I really got into a very deep sadness that I hadn't experienced before. And I had been vegan for a long time when I started that. That was like 6 years ago or so. I couldn't continue with that series because it was too much for me. But in a book like this one, Rainer the House Wolf, which it's still like a vegan book, and we're showing hard parts too. Like when Rainer meets Patrick, he had just jumped from this truck in on its way to the slaughterhouse. And there is an illustration where you can see the eyes of Patrick's friends being behind in the truck. And there is this moment when finally Patrick and Rainer reach the nature channel, which is what they are seeking, like the real nature. They think it's the nature channel, but they see this beautiful landscape, and I painted them where Patrick has a tear falling on his side. And when I look at that illustration, it makes me want to cry still in a very beautiful way, because it's like these characters, they are finally finding what they wanted to see, what they dreamed about, and I think that that emotion can be transmitted to other people who are going to see this illustration, and can be very, very powerful, and maybe change the way they think,
Yeah, and I think one sort of disadvantage that a lot of vegan outreach has is that people find it a very unpleasant topic. And there's so many unpleasant things out there in the world. You turn on the news and it's just one terrible thing after another. And we've been doing street outreach. When we were in Kansas City, we did street outreach where we were just showing people directly images of factory farms. And some people were very grateful to see it, but there are other people who will just turn off immediately because they don't want to think about anything unpleasant. So I think there also need to be positive vegan works. Like this book, it explores some difficult subjects, but it's really just a fun dog adventure story at its heart. And a child can like read it, or a teenager or whoever, and mainly have a good time at the same time as we're hoping they're going to reflect on some deeper issues as well. So I think we need to also find space in the vegan movement for a lot of humor and positivity. It's like you said, you became vegan out of love, not out of just seeing something terrible, right? So it's really that love that we have to inspire.
And I love hearing about Patrick. He's actually the logo of this podcast. It's a pig escaping a slaughter a truck distant to a slaughterhouse. So that imagery is poignant for me. At the same time, and I told this story before, when I hired an artist, his name is Frank, to design the logo for this podcast, and he presented the pig, I felt kind of disgusted. And, I was conditioned all my life to think of pigs as being, this dirty, creature that, does not deserve to be on any visual art project or anything, of worth. And that's the very feeling, of disgust I had was the reason why I selected that image. Do you think there is such a thing as an ugly animal, a disgusting animal versus a beautiful animal? Like, dogs are the universally beloved animals, and people see dogs and they smile. Why don't we smile when we see a pig?
Yeah, well, pigs have such big personalities, Like when you get to meet these animals, even like chickens and goats, you see that they all shine. They have the things they like, the things they don't like, the naughty things they like to do, just as dogs, as cats. And I'm very grateful that I got the opportunity to work with these animals in different farms or visiting sanctuaries and see them. And also, my mom used to have a little farm with ducks, chickens, everything, and I would enjoy feeding them, being with them. But there are some creatures, like, for example, insects, that some people might be freaked out by. And I can understand, like, for example, with cockroaches, they will freak me out if I see them walking really fast towards me, but I wouldn't want to kill them. Like, I understand that all these animals have the right to live and to be happy and do what they want to do, So I understand the feeling of some people, because they might never have connected with them in a different way. They might never had realized that these creatures have their lives, their things that they like to do. But for example, just going back to the book again, there are different animals, different beetles and insects that sing. They are sharing these little poems, and I think it's really cute and funny. They have their perspective and things to say in the story, and it's in a way of a short poem.
Yeah, there's a snail in the book as well. There's, of course, many people might see pigs as filthy animals, but what about like slugs? How many people out there are really telling the slugs story? There's animals that we feel even more disgust for than pigs. A lot, there are people who have pigs as pets, but most people, if they see a slug or they see a spider or something, they want it to go away as fast as possible. But when you look at any animal and you see that it has eyes and it has a nose and it has ears, they might come in a different form from our eyes, ears, nose, mouth. Then it means that they also have a heart and they also have lungs. And if they share all of these features with us, then why wouldn't they have consciousness? Why wouldn't they have a spirit and a soul and an imagination? It doesn't make sense for them to share absolutely everything with humans except for these interior components. So, no, I don't think there's such thing as an ugly animal. I think the ugliness is in the human eye. The ugliness is in the way that we have been indoctrinated into seeing some animals as beautiful, other animals as food, other animals as just scary or filthy or disgusting. Like in the United States and in many countries, the cow is something that people eat. In India, the cow is very sacred, and they still get food from the cow through milking and through cheese. And there's a lot to say about India's relationship with cattle, but it just goes to show that how we feel about animals is very culturally constructed. It isn't really based in reality. When you actually look at reality, you see that all animals want to live. All animals want to escape pain. That's just scientific fact. That's why those animals have survived evolution or intelligent design, however you want to think about it. That's why animals are still here after millions of years, is because they want to be here.
And it's so smart to take Reynard, who is the dog, this beloved, universally beloved creature, and in a way use him to introduce the reader to all of the other less beloved animals, but who deserve that kind of love. So, a really good call from you, and a really smart move. And I guess my other hope about this book is to see it being adapted to maybe something like an animation, or because
We would love to do that. Yes.
I mean, I see the potential for that. It sounds, like a wonderful thing that children would like to see, to watch on Amazon Prime or Netflix or something. That would be wonderful.
It will be cool. We'll start with trying to sell a few hundred copies. But we've also imagined such things, because a Reynard, everybody loves their dog. We do think Reynard is particularly awesome and charismatic, and people often stop him in the street and compliment him on his beauty. So I think, children would love to see more of his adventures. And whether or not there is a cartoon at any point or an animation, I'm sure there will be a Reynard sequel at some point.
Well, our dog Rainer has at least two or three songs that we have composed for him.
Yeah. He's inspired quite a lot.
Yeah, but this book also feels really musical, the way it's meant to be read out loud, and when everything rhymes, it has this rhythm and this music in it. Some scenes are just like rap scenes. So I see the potential for creating something really musical with it.
Yes, definitely. That's another layer of awesomeness to it. And you do have a special relationship with with that dog, because, you know, if I think about the birds I care for and my cats, I would not be inspired to compose a song for my cat, like never in a million years, or write a book about her. Like, she's a, you know, I love her, I truly do, but not to that point.
Yeah, well, the songs that I have written about Reynard have been when we have been very far away from him, you know? So it's like when you're missing somebody, that's when you feel inspired. If you were very far from your cat, you might just pick up the guitar and start singing.
Okay, now I understand the context.
Yeah, they are love songs for Reynard.
My cat is a special case, too. You know, there are more difficult animals out there to love. You talked about how it's a vegan dog. Is it possible to have a vegan dog?
Well, we think it is because he's alive and well and thriving, and sometimes he has too much energy for us.
Yeah, Reynard is extremely energetic. And when we first were looking into whether you could raise a vegan dog, we discovered a dog called Bramble. Bramble the vegan dog, which was a border collie who was in the Guinness Book of World Records for being the longest lived dog ever. Bramble the vegan dog lived to 25 years of age. And it wasn't just a, you know, sort of freak incident, because this woman's other dogs, they were also 19, 20, 21 years of age. All of them were living basically off of stir fry, you know, off of rice and lentils and some soy protein and quite a lot of veggies. She would feed them just one time a day. Her name is Anne Heritage. And that was, you know, decades ago. Now there is a thriving industry where you can get vegan kibble for your dog. And we give our dog some vegan kibble because we know that it has the supplementation that they need. But we also cook them just a basic rice, lentil, and we save all of our vegetable scraps. You know, when you're making food for yourself and you're chopping up carrots and broccoli, et cetera, and there are parts that get tossed out, we cook those into the food for our animals so that those nutrients don't go to waste and they contribute to their health. And I think, you know, life is a lot more flexible than we give it credit for. Just look at humans. There are humans that live off of all meat, like the Inuit. And then there are humans such as vegans who live off of all plants. There are bears that eat a lot of meat. You've got the panda bear, which evolved to only eat plants. So there is this flexibility in nature. And even wolves, which we think of as carnivores, actually wolves will eat quite a lot of plants when they're out just running in the forest. They will forage, they will chew on leaves and eat grass. And dogs especially have been domesticated for tens of thousands of years to have a much more flexible diet. So, you know, I think a lot of people have theories about, can a dog be vegan? More important than theories are results. When you've got a dog who is in the Guinness Book of World Record, and most people's dogs are living to be 10 or 12 years of age, if that, and this dog lived to be twice that length, those results are much more important than any preconceptions a person might have. So we have seen no shortage of energy. We have seen no health problems. Reynard's been vegan for several years now, and he has beautiful fur and loads of energy and clean teeth. We adopted another dog whose name is Shanti, and she originally was not vegan, and we noticed that she smelled pretty bad.
She had very bad breath.
Yeah, very strong odor. And just a few months after being on a vegan diet, a whole foods vegan diet, she now smells much, much better. So you can do it for your own sake as well if you want to have a dog that doesn't smell bad.
But what a coincidence, because I, you know, after setting my mind to interviewing you, I discovered the story of Anne Heritage, and I wanted to interview her as well. And she followed me back on Instagram. So, you know, to be continued, but I think I would love to get her on the podcast as well and talk about her dog.
Yeah. I mean, when she did it, she was kind of a pioneer. And now there are thousands and thousands of people raising dogs on a vegan diet. So It can definitely be done.
Yes, and if it, makes them smell better. I mean, I have to say, the smell of dogs, it's not my favorite thing in the world, but I did notice that some dogs, smell of the same, race smell have different smells. And I did wonder, does it have to do with their lifestyle or maybe diet? So it's a question I will ask her as well.
Yeah, well, the same as people. If somebody is eating a lot of animals, then they have a highly acidic diet, and it will make them smell, to my nose, much worse. Whereas vegans, not trying to toot our own horn here, but I do think vegans smell better, taste better, look better, just all around. Your body is going to show that you're living a cleaner life.
I agree. I did notice that as well. So Tom, Saul, thank you so much for having answered my questions. What a pleasant conversation I've had, and what a wonderful project, you've given birth to. I really wish you the success and hopefully an animation of that. Animation, adaptation of the book. Did you want to add something before we stop the recording?
I think it's been a wonderful conversation, and we're very grateful for your invitation. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. So, yeah, we look forward to sharing Reynard's story and his teachings with readers of all ages. And we hope that everyone feels inspired also to find ways to share whatever they are feeling internally. How do you share that with others? For us, it was in making this book. For somebody else, it might be in making a blog post or a podcast or, writing a postcard or playing music on the street or, who knows what form it might come in. Everybody has sort of different skills and different gifts, but the key is to want to share with the world.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.